accession number 31509, reel 14.
Sign.
This is Gavin Douglas, and we're now on reel 14. I was going to ask you what happened when you left Singapore, and the squadron, 28th Squadron, was transferred to a new leader. I believe you went back to India with a new squadron.
Yes, that is correct. I was, after I'd handed over the 28th Squadron to its new squadron leader, I was immediately posted to Rizalpur, which is in the northwest frontier of the former India. And there I was told to take over as squadron leader the command of 152 Squadron, which was a Tempest 2 Squadron. This was the last thing in piston engine aircraft. After that, the Air Force converted it to jets. You couldn't get any faster with a piston engine aircraft with propellers than you could in a Tempest 2. Well, it was peacetime.
Yes, and well, is this the plane that was firing rockets?
Yes, I was going to mention that. It was a Tempest 2. It was a rocket-firing aircraft. We had two rocket launchers under each wing. And it was said that the hitting power of a Tempest with its rockets was equal to the broadside of a British light British cruiser. We weren't doing as much flying as we did in wartime, of course, peacetime things. We had to economize on fuel that was being used, and everything was concentrated on training young pilots who had, most of them had missed out on the war. But the future course of the Royal Air Force in India, which previously was the defense of the Northwest Frontier, was actually already politically about to end. Negotiations were going on at the time between the various countries about India getting its independence. There were arguments on both sides whether they should have it or whether they shouldn't. And in the meantime, it was progressing slowly but surely towards getting their independence. And that meant that India, I won't go into all that because it's political, but India was split up eventually into India and Pakistan. But all before that happened, I only mention it because it affected the way things were going as far as finances and hours that we flew and so on and so forth. One of the things I was asked to do was to take a flight of Tempest 2s, fly it from Rizalpur to Quetta, which is where the Staff College, Indian Staff College was, which was of course at that time the British Staff College in the Far East, and give them a demonstration of the hitting power of a Tempest 2, and the idea of the speed and straight and level and in a dive as a sort of show for them. And an old truck was put out in the open in a safe area, and Staff College students all lined up and sat behind rocks and so on and watched the display. And of course, when we hit the truck, it disintegrated into a million fragments. It was quite stupendous. Then the ground officer called me up on radio and said the Staff College students would very much like to see what the speed of a Tempest 2 is in a dive, and if you would, whilst descending, call out and say what the speed is on your airspeed indicator. And I said, well, I'll do that. I'll go up to about 10,000 feet and I'll dive steeply and call out the speed as I dive. This actually was a very dangerous maneuver because I was watching the speedometer in the dive and not watching the ground. And as I dived, I was the only one doing this. I didn't get the whole squadron to do it. I was calling out 350, 400, 450, 480, just under 500 miles. And I suddenly realized, God, the ground, well, it's coming up so fast, I thought I may not pull out. And I started, the Tempest wasn't heavy like a P-47 Thunderbolt. It would fly round in a parabola, but if you pull the stick back too quickly, you'd get what was called a high-speed stall, and the aircraft would not fly anymore. It would be like a brick, and it would crash into the ground and kill a lot of the staff colleagues as well, because it was right over their heads. Well, as it was, I did successfully pull out of the dive, but they all had to get kneel down on the ground because it just whooshed over their heads as I pulled out. And I don't know who had the biggest fright, they or I. All was well. We flew back to Bristlepaw, and I was feeling a bit shaky then. I think it was idiotic thing I did, concentrating too much on calling out the speed and not watching where I was in the air. Got back to Bristlepaw, and the next thing that happened just before the end of our time, in my time anyway, in Bristlepaw, was there was some political nonsense going on in what was called the Black Mountain country of Hazara, which is just north of the northwest frontier. Various tribes were being truculent and misbehaving, and the political department couldn't handle them. They weren't listening to reason. And so the old system which had been in practice before the war had recourse to, and we were ordered to go fly over the area, and particularly the village where most of the trouble was coming from, and drop leaflets. These leaflets were white, and in the leaflets they said that we were going to carry out a punitive operation on our village and forts if they didn't come to heel or come to terms with the political, the Northwest political department, and that if they didn't behave themselves and come to terms within a week, we would be back in a week's time, and we would then destroy their village. Well, it must be remembered that the villages were only made of mud, and the stronger towers were built of mud bricks, which was not very strong, and could easily be replaced. So it was a matter of a temporary inconvenience and a little expense for them, but not very much, to put things to rights again. But rather than have to do that, they usually came to terms. Well, in this case, that's all that happened. We went up and we flew around the area. We dive bombed the village in mock dives. We didn't drop anything except the leaflets afterwards. And all the villagers came out, and they saw there was a private air show being put on. And they all cheered and waved their hands, and it was rather funny, really, because they were enjoying this show just as much as we were. There was no firing being done. Well, we dropped the leaflets, and we weren't asked to go back again a week later, as we might have been had they not come to terms. The old system was that if they didn't come to terms at the end of a week, the day before, the squadron would go out and drop red leaflets, and it would tell the villagers that the hour at which we would come over the following day and destroy their village, and also gave them an area where they could go and stand safely and watch it if necessary, but telling them to get everybody out of the village, and if that didn't do any good, we would carry on until they did. What used to happen before the war, when this was being done, was when they discovered that they could get £2,000 for every person who was killed accidentally in the bombing in their villages. They were typically Pathan. They had, of course, as everybody does, elderly women who were widows in the villages, and the life of a widow in most Islamic countries, especially in those days anyway, was hardly worth living. And when they knew that they could bring each of them £2,000 into the tribal coffers, they were not unwilling to have their lives ended. Maybe with a little bit of coercion from the men, I don't know, none of us were over there at the time. But the fact is that a few old women would be left in the villages, and of course, if their building was hit, as it only was, they would be killed. Well, the Pathans had profited both ways. They had got rid of extra mouths to feed, because it's a very difficult country to live off, and every extra mouth that's not productive and doing work is a burden. And so that was one thing. The other thing was they would complain politically, and the complaints would go to Geneva, and questions would be asked over what had happened and how it had, the British had killed some helpless old women, and usually it was exaggerated, probably children were added to it, and it went down very badly with everybody who didn't know the real facts. And of course the Pathans were clever chaps, they're no fools in that way, they're full of cunning. They loved to see how we would be discomfited by reports that we had brutally attacked them and killed their women, and at the same time we'd given them £2,000 for it. So this is a typical Pathan situation, very much like the Irish situation that we had experienced in the Western world.
Is this the sort of brutal British term that was used at the time?
It was euphonic to say brutal British. I think that's how the somebody said it once and they caught on. It wasn't the awful British or the dreadful British, but brutal British sounded more emphatic. And anyway, well, we didn't have to do that. I'm just saying what happened in the early days of dropping white leaflets and a week later dropping red leaflets, which we would have had to do had they not come to terms with the political, whatever the dispute was. I had no idea what the dispute was. We were told by the politicals that we would have to do this, and it was okayed by headquarters in India, and we took our orders to go and do what we were told to do, which we did. Shortly after that, my time came to go back to England. 152 Squadron had already been earmarked to be left in India when partition eventually took place, and would be one of the first presents that would be given to the new independent countries. 5 Squadron was another one, I can't remember the rest, but a lot of equipment, artillery, other weaponry, airplanes, destroyers, and so on and so forth. It was decided that rather than scrap them, we would donate them to the countries to give them a start with their armed forces. And 152 Squadron, which is all I'm concerned with, was one of those that was earmarked to go to the Indian Air Force. I was flown home to England. I hadn't been back since 1938. It was 9 years since I had seen England. And I was given a month's disembarkation leave. And then I awaited my posting orders, and they came through. I had hoped to go to Duxford, which I had visited whilst I was on leave, and be converted onto Meteors or whatever jet aircraft they had there, and be, with luck, post to another squadron, perhaps not a squadron leader, but certainly as a flight commander because of my promotion.
Yes, if you would excuse me, we did cover all of this now. Yes, we covered everything now. It was just getting that little piece in, because I wanted now to continue.
Fine,
as you're in the Northwest Frontier area, which is, of course, of great interest today, with the events in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So it would be lovely to ask you now about the work, the job you were offered at the end of 1960, I believe, wasn't it? You left your previous firm, you were saying how your company had their coastal licence withdrawn by the Indian government and had to relocate to London. And now I want to pick up where you actually changed your job and went to that area again, if you would be good enough.
Yes, I was just thinking where to lead India. Shall I say that I knew nothing about these dams. I received a letter from David Graham saying, Gavin, I'm back in this part of the world. I'd met him in India earlier, you see. And he said, guess what? The Canadian government is building a dam up in the Northwest Frontier. That's how it all started, you see.
And then he said,
we're having trouble because of language problems. Yeah. And would you come up and you know, all that sort of thing. And
what date would this have been, roughly?
I'm just trying to think. I joined McInnes in 40. It would be the end of 55, 1955, because I started. Let's see, let me get this absolutely right. The war ended in 45.
Yes.
I went to McInnes in 48. Yes, it would be the end of 55, because my job with Angus Robinson started in 56, January. Yeah. So I can lead in from there.
Yes, if you would please, Gavin. Sorry to interrupt
No.
But I think why I'm doing it this way is because it links in very much with the Northwest Frontier, 1946-47. Yes. Yes, right.
Well, I was in Bombay I was with McKinnon Mackenzie in Bombay, and I'd just come back from a month's leave in South India, where I had gone trout fishing in the Nilgiri Mountains. And I found a letter waiting for me from a friend of mine, David Graham, who said that he was back in our part of the world, in the East, and that he had got a job with Angus Robinson Limited, who were building a dam in northwest Pakistan, and which, of course, was the old northwest India. Although there was no problem, languages with educated Pakistanis, the engineers and doctors and senior men, they had 9,000 Pathan labourers who didn't speak a word of English, or many of them didn't speak any Urdu, and they were having language problems. And he knew that I spoke Pashto as well as Urdu, and he said, we're looking for somebody who would come and take over the hiring side and be personal manager of the whole project as well. And I said, mentioned your name to the construction manager, Corey Robbins, and he said, well, why don't you invite him to come up and see us? He sounds as though he's the kind of chap we want to help us with this project. And so I read this letter, and before I went, I found out a little bit more about it. And I went to one of our directors, or partners of McKinnon's, as they were called in those days, Kenneth Campbell, and told him the story, and I said, look, I've received this letter. It's a kind of an SOS. I'd like to go up and see it, but I know I've just had my leave for the year, and I not do any more, but it could be of value. And he was very understanding. He said, well, yes, sir, how long do you want to go? And he said, you can't spare it for more than a week. So I said, well, easily be done in a week. I'll fly up and fly back, be there for maybe 2 or 3 days just to see them and for them to see me and to discuss things. And this is what happened. He let me go. I went up there and I found this dam was planned to be built in tribal territory where there is a lot of trouble going on right now. It was on the Kabul River, which comes past Kabul, but crosses this no man's land before it enters Pakistan. And it was about 10 miles upstream. There's a place called Warsak, which is spelled W-A-R-S-A-K, and it was called the Warsak Dam. Now, somebody had to pay for this dam, of course, and it was in order to help Pakistan, and the same thing was happening in India, or to India. The Colombo Plan was formed over by the contributory countries, which were all part of the empire, the former empire, New Zealand, Australia, and pooled money together to provide enough resources to pay for engineering projects of this sort to develop Pakistan. They couldn't afford to do it themselves, so they all banded together under the Colombo Plan to produce the necessary finances. The country that was that produced possibly most of the money was Canada, and they were given the chance of building the dam as a reward, and of course they had plenty of engineers people experienced in that kind of work, and of course they were given the project of building the Wartag Dam, which was on a cost plus basis, which of course every constructor likes, because whatever it costs, if the costs go beyond a certain thing, the company doesn't pay, it's paid for by the government. And it's an expensive way of doing things, but it's also a very quick way of doing things. You've got plenty of money, you can get on with the job and finish it more quickly. So that way, sometimes it's more economical, because you have an overrun of expenses going on for extra years. Well, that costs more in the long run than if you can get done quickly and pay a bit more for it to start with. Well, I went back and told Kenneth Campbell that they had offered me a job, and he said, well, tell me more. And he offered me a tax-free dollar salary, much more money than I was getting with McKinnon's. And the first thing he said was, of course, we couldn't match that salary, Gavin. If you really think that this would be a good move for you, we won't step in your way, and we won't insist on the usual 3 months' notice. And you can go at the end of this month, in about 10 days' time, if you really wish to. And I said, well, that's very, very kind of you, and I think it would help everybody, especially the goodwill side of things, and the dam constructors, I think I would like to go start as soon as possible, because I saw myself that they were having problems. So on the 2nd of January, I find myself with my wife in Pakistan. We'd taken the ship from Karachi from Bombay to Karachi, and arrived there on the day after New Year's Day. And I then took the train up to Peshawar, and from Peshawar they sent me transport, and I was driven up the frontier, over the frontier, to Wartag, which was about, if I remember rightly, about a dozen miles or so from Peshawar. But you passed, you took the road up to Jamrud, which is the famous old fort, which was the beginning of the Khyber Pass, the famous Khyber Pass, and then you went north up towards Wartag. It was a newly built road, recently macadamized. The Pakistani government had spent a certain amount of money on getting things ready for the construction company. They had built built bungalows for accommodation, and everything was going along to house people. But the work on the dam was suffering, because in Pakistan at that time, there were hardly, apart from newly trained engineers and people of that sort, there were no construction workers that knew anything. There were people who had driven tanks in the army during the war, but they'd never operated bulldozers, or they didn't know anything about other heavy equipment. And we had to start absolutely from scratch. So we had to set up a school to teach people to weld and to fit pipes and do plumbing and level ground and do excavations and pour concrete and all these things, which all jobs calling for a certain amount of a lot of expertise, not just a certain amount, a lot of expertise. And the, of course, we had Canadian foremen in charge of these jobs, and had these men working under them, who were quick learners. I must say that. And by the time we'd been there for about a year, we had quite a good nucleus of construction workers. Why Pakistan had such a dearth of experts of that sort at the time was because before partition, the whole of the Northwest India was the people who were artisans, not just laborers, but mostly Sikhs. They were the best carpenters, the best welders, the best electricians, the best canal builders and all that. But, of course, they were now on the Indian side, those that hadn't been killed in the transition. And Pakistan was left with very, very few people who had any kind of mechanical expertise, which is the reason why we had to start school. Well, when the project was going at its best, I suppose, we had about 9,000 Pakistanis, most of them, of course, doing the menial jobs. They were third-grade carpenters and second-grade carpenters and plasterers and cement workers and that. About 9,900 workers on the payroll at the time. And it was going fine up to a point. Every now and again, there'd be a complaint. The construction manager would come in and say, our work gangs down on the river 2 miles upstream have been held up. A group of Pathans with rifles saying they've got to stop work. And of course, it was the good old tricks of trying to get more money. And they asked what their complaint was, and the dam, the electricity, which was going to give them all cheap power later, was being held up. And didn't this matter to them? Oh, yes, it did, they said. But if you would only lay electric power onto our village, so that our women don't have to go down to the river and be insulted by workers down there, seeing them carrying the water, all sorts of ridiculous excuses. And so our arm was continually being twisted to do these little things on the side. The Pathan has a gift of the gab. He's very plausible, and it was a game on their part, and they knew they could win the game because they would just selfishly stop work until they got what they wanted. And we knew this, and we thought, well, it's not very much, and so we gave them what they want. But this happened many, many times.